it. A giant fist clutched his body, and all the air disappeared from his lungs. He gasped in response, trying to breathe, fighting to keep from choking. Then he was standing in a twilit clearing of wintry grasses and barren earth, surrounded by sparse woods and a deeply clouded sky. Paranor was gone. The world of the Four Lands was gone. Nothing he was looking at reminded him of home, except, perhaps, for the bleaker places he had visited, like the Slags or the Clue. He stared blankly for a moment, making the comparisons, measuring the differences in his head, looking slowly about as he did so. What struck him first was how dark things were. It didn't seem to be nightfall, but the sun was nowhere to be seen, the brightness of the overcast sky like a pale reflection off clouded waters. The trees and grasses were washed of color, their greens muted and dulled. He peered into the distance. There wasn't much to see, the woods fading into shifting walls of mist, the sky and earth coming together miles away in a grayish haze, the mountains stark and barren, the woods skeletal and empty-looking. He could not imagine what lived there. He had the feeling that whatever did spent most of the time hunkered down and watchful. He had a feeling that here you were either pursuer or pursued, hunter or prey. "I hate this world already," he thought. He was grasping the dark wand so tightly that his hands hurt. He loosened his grip on the staff and forced himself to take a few deep breaths to stay calm. He had made the crossing. The magic of the staff had done its job, bringing him out of the Four Lands and into the Forbidding. He could scarcely believe it, and in truth, he might not have if everything did not look and feel exactly right for what the Forbidding should be. Despite the oppressiveness of his surroundings, he felt an odd sense of relief, as if the hardest part of the task given him by the King of the Silver River were finished. But he knew that wasn't so, that the hardest part lay ahead. He had accomplished much since he had left Patch Run. He had crossed half the Four Lands to find the Dark Wand and bring it back to Paranor. He had endured hardships and privations of a sort few survived. He had escaped his enemies time and again. But just staying alive in this dark place would take all the strength he had, and then some. He finished scanning his surroundings, found nothing useful, stood for a moment longer, and then sat down to gather his thoughts. He wondered briefly about his parents. There was no way for them to know what had happened to him unless Kyber managed to reach them. At least they were free of Paranor and the druids. They would not be tricked again by Shadea Aru and her minions. He was still bothered by the fact that the King of the Silver River had failed to warn them, as he had promised he would. Unless they had ignored that warning, of course, and had determined to help him no matter what the risk. His mother would think like that. His mother would brave anything for him. As would any of his friends and companions on this journey, he thought. As all of them had. He found himself missing them, desperately. Steady Tagwin, brave Kermadec, resourceful Kyber, and even truculent Atalan. But most of all, he missed Cinnaminson. Just thinking of her made him ache in a way nothing else ever had. He tried to picture her as he remembered her best, free and alive, smiling at him on the decks of the Skatelo, reaching out to take his hand. He tried not to think of where she was and what had become of her, but he couldn't quite manage it. He compressed his lips in a tight line and forced himself to think instead of other things. He was alone for the moment, at least until he found his aunt, and there was nothing he could do to change that. He hoped the others were all right, that they had found ways to escape their predicaments, but wondering if they had was just another dead end in his thinking. What he must think about was finding his aunt, the Ard Rhys, and bringing her home safe. He started as sudden heat flooded through his palms. The runes of the dark wand were glowing, turning the staff warm. He got to his feet quickly and looked around, wondering if the staff were warning him of hidden danger, but he sensed nothing. He stared down at the staff once more, but the runes had dimmed and the wood gone cool. He frowned in confusion. Something had triggered the reaction, but what was it? He looked around. Nothing. He looked back at the staff. Was it something inside him? Was the staff responding to him? He knew already that they were connected, sufficiently so that he had been able to find it when it was taken away by Trant Rowan, and had known instinctively how to trigger its magic when crossing from his world into this one. The staff responded to his needs. Was it doing so here? Was it responding to his need to find Grianne Ormsford? Experimenting, he turned his thoughts to his aunt, asking himself where she was and how he could find her. At once, the runes turned fiery, pulsating beneath his hands, enveloping the entire staff in a red glow. He grinned. Now he knew what the staff could do, but he still didn't know how to make practical use of it. The grayness of the day was fading rapidly toward night, the sky darkening and shadows beginning to drape the world below. Penn glanced around, thinking that he did not want to be caught out in the open once night arrived. He needed to find shelter, but first he needed to determine which way he should go. To do that, he needed to figure out how to use the dark wand. He looked at it again, turning his thoughts away from his quest, watching the brightness of the runes fade. Maybe if he asked it to show him where his aunt was, it would do so. If he thought about a direction to take in the same way he thought about looking for her, perhaps the runes would show him something. He gave it a try. He thought about his aunt, about his need to find her, watched the runes brighten anew, then started thinking about directions he might take, projecting himself going first one way and then another. Nothing happened. The runes stayed bright, but did not respond in any way to his silent questions. He shook his head in disgust. So much for that approach. Still, there had to be a way. He decided to try something else. Keeping his thoughts focused on his aunt, he started walking toward the last of the light, a direction he assumed might be west, but the runes dimmed almost at once. He stopped and turned around to walk the other way, toward the encroaching darkness, which would be east. Again, the runes darkened. But at least he was getting a clear response, he thought. He turned south, toward the mountains that were closest to where he stood. Instantly, the runes turned fiery. He felt a surge of elation. He would go that way. He started walking, the staff held before him in both hands like a compass, the runes glowing brightly, providing him with both light and reassurance. All around, the shadows thickened and the world began to change. What had been indistinct before began to lose all shape and form until most of what he could see was distinguished by little more than changes in color and brightness. He could still make out the peaks ahead of him, but little else. He would have to find shelter soon. He was further persuaded of that when he noticed movement in the shadows. Movement that hadn't been there earlier. He caught only glimpses of it, sudden dartings like the scurrying of small furry animals, except that there were no small furry animals living within the forbidding, at least not ones that were likely to be friendly. In any case, he didn't think he wanted to find out. Other than the dark wand, all he carried for protection was a long knife he had taken from one of the guards. But he didn't think it would prove much of a weapon against the things that lived in the forbidding, especially after dark. He trudged on, keeping as much to the open as he could manage, following the dictates of the staff while keeping close watch on his surroundings. Once, something massive flew overhead, a great, winged creature that, had it fallen on him, would have crushed him instantly. He froze when he saw it, distant and indistinct, and he did not move again until he was certain it was gone. He saw other things, too. He saw cat-like creatures leaping through the dead-limbed trees, and lizard things that slithered along the earth through the grasses and scrub. He started to hear hissing and snarling, the sounds of hunters at work. Once, a shriek momentarily brought his heart to his throat. In the silence that followed, he could hear the rasp of his own frightened breathing. "I am alone here," he kept thinking. "I am alone, and I have no idea what lives here or how to defend myself." He swallowed hard. "I wish I weren't so afraid." Darkness was almost complete by then, and he had reached the lower slopes of the mountains that blocked the way forward. Clusters of boulders formed huge barriers that rose before him like sentries to challenge his passage. The bare limbs of trees rose against the sky like the finger bones of giants long dead. He saw that a trail led upward through the maze to a pass that, in turn, opened toward the mountains, to the land beyond. But the way forward was long and arduous, and with the fall of darkness, he would not get far before he couldn't see at all. So he moved into the center of the tree trunks and boulder piles, found a shelter in the rocks where he was protected on three sides, and settled in. He quit thinking about his aunt, turned his thoughts away from his search, and watched the light of the runes fade. He had nothing to eat or drink, so he tried not to think about how hungry and thirsty he was. Beyond his shelter, the world was ink black, devoid of light from moon or stars, empty of sky. But there were sounds everywhere, sharp and piercing, low and rumbling, sudden and slow to build and die. There were sounds of every sort, but none of them familiar, and none pleasant. Penn wedged himself into one corner of his shelter, clasped his arms about the dark wand, and took out the long knife and placed it against his chest. He sat staring out into the darkness for a long time before he fell asleep. When he awoke, the dragon was staring at him. He didn't realize it was there at first. He woke slowly and lethargically, still half asleep as he opened his eyes to look around. He didn't know where he was. He was stretched out on the hard ground, his bones aching and his muscles sore. The world was dark and hazy. There was no sunshine, no bright color, and no welcoming warmth or birdsong to encourage his rising. The new day was cloaked in sullen stillness and a deep gray wash that made him want to go back to sleep. He closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them again as his head cleared and he remembered that he was inside the forbidding. He glanced down. The long knife was still in his hands, his fingers stiff from gripping it. The dark wand was clutched to his chest, its runes pulsating softly, coming alive with the day. He stared at the staff doubtfully. Why was it glowing? He couldn't remember thinking about his search for his aunt or anything that would have made it brighten. Then, his attention was drawn to a huge cluster of mottled boulders settled squarely in front of him. He didn't remember those boulders being there the night before, and wasn't sure how he could have missed seeing them, even in the dark. It was like having a wall materialize out of nowhere, a great, massive barrier that somehow didn't seem to quite belong. He stared at them in confusion. A window-size eye blinked, a lazy lowering and lifting of a scaly lid. Penn caught his breath and held it. The cluster of rocks began to assume shape and take on definition. Limbs studded with spikes crooked awkwardly at the joints to end in claws that were each the size of his leg. Scales larger than blankets layered a body that would dwarf a small cottage. Bony ridges ran in parallel lines down a broad back and long reticulated tail. A triangular head was tucked between its forelegs, encrusted snout and brow thick with armor and blunt horns.
"Shades," he whispered.
He had never seen a dragon, of course. No one in his lifetime had ever seen a dragon. Most types were extinct. Those that weren't were consigned to the forbidding, like the one before him, or so deeply and thoroughly entrenched in mountain caverns and wilderness forests that no human had ever ventured in far enough to encounter them. But he knew what dragons were and what they looked like, and the creature facing him was clearly a dragon. It was easily the biggest living creature that Penn had ever seen. It was bigger than he had imagined anything could be. Fascinated in spite of himself, he stared at it. He wondered what it was doing there. He wondered why it hadn't eaten him. He wondered if it planned to. He became aware all at once that it was looking at him. It was watching through half-closed lids with a sleepy, almost dreamy gaze. It seemed mesmerized, like a cat stretched out for a nap, lazy and content, drifting in and out of private reveries. Then it occurred to him, almost as an afterthought, that the dragon wasn't looking at him. It was looking at the dark wand, or more particularly, at the glow of its runes. At first, he thought he must be mistaken. After all, why would the dragon be interested in the staff and its runes? Was the beast sentient? It certainly didn't look it. But maybe it understood something of magic and of talismans and recognized the dark wand for what it was. He didn't think that was right, though. The way the dragon was watching the staff suggested that it was all but hypnotized, that its interest was one of almost primordial attraction. Penn glanced down, watching the way the light played across the runes, how it worked itself up and down the staff in ever-changing patterns, how it brightened and dimmed, pulsed and steadied, reinventing itself over and over. The dragon was watching too, fascinated by the movement of the light as it danced from rune to rune. Penn tried an experiment. Taking his cloak, he covered the top half of the staff, blocking the light. Instantly, the great horn-encrusted head lifted, the triangular snout swung about, and its maw split wide in a hiss that sounded like an explosion. Rows of blackened teeth revealed themselves, some still clotted with bits of flesh, some with bones wedged between them. A gaping throat as black as damp ashes pulsed and shimmered, and the stench of carrion on its breath flattened the boy against the rock wall of his all-too-inadequate shelter. Penn gagged and nearly fainted, but he retained sufficient presence of mind to uncloak the dark wand at once. As the runes began anew their intricate play across the polished surface of the wood, the dragon slowly settled back into place, its maw closing, its eyelids drooping content. "Well, that was really a bad idea," Penn thought, taking great gulps of air to clear his head. He remained where he was for a moment, sagging against the wall of his shelter, the dark wand held firmly in front of him, his talisman against a monster with breath that would melt iron. He hung his head for a time, thinking he was going to vomit, but when the nausea had passed, he straightened and looked out again at the dragon, trying to think what to do. He still wasn't certain what was happening with the dark wand, which, until then, he had assumed would respond only to his thoughts of the Ard Ris. But it had apparently begun to glow even before he was awake and knew what was happening. How could that be? He returned his attention to the dragon, saw how its eyes were fixed on the glowing runes, listened to how its breathing came slowly and evenly as it crouched there, waiting. Waiting on what? He didn't know. How long did dragons wait on things anyway? He wondered suddenly if he was trapped. He hadn't thought of it before, but it might well be that just as the dragon wouldn't let him cover up the light, it wouldn't let him take it away either. That would mean that he was stuck in these rocks until the dragon tired of him and moved on. Which might take a very long time, he realized. Time he didn't have to spare. He took a moment to consider his options. He didn't have many to consider. He could stay where he was until the dragon grew bored and went away, or he could try leaving and hope the dragon didn't follow, or if it did follow, that it wouldn't follow for long, and that it wouldn't eat him. He didn't like where his thinking was taking him, so he abandoned it in favor of trying to decide what else he might do to help himself. The long knife he carried was all but useless against something the size of the dragon, so there was no point in relying on that. Of course, any weapon was all but useless against a beast as big as that one. A whole army was probably useless. He might try using his magic. It was a reach. He didn't even know if his magic would work in the forbidding. But he didn't have anything else he could look to for help, and he had to do more than sit around waiting for the dragon to decide to eat him. His magic had worked with the moor cat they had encountered in the slags well enough that it had saved his life. It was conceivable that it might work here as well. But how should he try to use it? He decided to find out first if it irritated the beast, because if it did, that was the end of the matter. He began by reaching out with his five senses, taking in everything he could discover about the creature, from the sound of its breathing to the baleful look in its sleepy eye. He scoured the monster from head to tail and back again, working at finding a connection, at trying to feel something of what the dragon felt. It was hard work, and in the end it yielded almost nothing. Dragons, apparently, didn't give much away. There was nothing for it but to try using the magic in the only way that seemed feasible, as a tool of communication. He had no idea how dragons communicated. All he had learned so far was how they breathed and how they reacted when irritated. Perhaps if he started there, a way might reveal itself. What made his efforts so difficult was that the dragon wasn't really interested in him at all. It was only interested in the dark wand. If it were the dark wand that was trying to communicate, he was certain that he would make better progress. But that wasn't possible, of course, so he would have to settle for using his own voice and hope the dragon gave something back. He began with an imitation of the dragon's breathing, slow and heavy and raw. Enhancing his efforts with his magic, giving them life, it still took him a while to get it right. Eventually, he was sounding exactly like a miniature version of the larger thing. The dragon blinked once, twice. When he began alternating the breathing with variations on the disgruntled hissing, the dragon lifted its head off its forefeet and looked at him. But it didn't seem inclined to do anything more than stare. Still, Penn kept at it, hoping for something more. Nothing happened. Eventually, the dragon lost interest, lowered its head to its forefeet, and went back to watching the dancing glow of the runes. Penn sank back, exhausted. He was getting nowhere. Worse, he was growing weak from the effort. He had not eaten or drunk anything since arriving and could not remember when he had done so before that. It had been more than a day. His throat was parched and he was feeling lightheaded. If he didn't get away soon, he was going to pass out from lack of nourishment. But what in the world was he supposed to do? He spent several hours trying to figure that out. He used his small magic in every conceivable way to entice the dragon into communicating, but the beast simply ignored him. It lay there across the opening to his shelter, a great scaly lump that refused to move. With one eye fixed steadily on the dark wand and its intriguing runes, it dozed like a monstrous cat in front of a mouse hole, transfixed by the movement of the light. It barely stirred for the whole of the time it kept watch, and then only to shift positions. After a while, Penn dozed off. He wasn't sure how long he slept, as the gray light that marked daytime in the forbidding was virtually unchanging from dawn to dusk, but when he awoke, he came to a decision. Rather than experiment further with the magic, he would simply try to leave. He had no idea if the dragon would permit it, but anything was better than doing nothing. Holding the dark wand in front of him so as not to disturb or obscure the play of the light across its runes, he stood and gathered his strength. He was so weak by then that it took him a few minutes to do so. When he felt sufficiently ready, he took a single step out from his shelter. The dragon blinked slowly. He took another step, and then another. The dragon's head came up. The horn-encrusted snout swung toward him, and a sharp hiss escaped through a pair of wide, flaring nostrils. Penn stopped at once, held his ground, and waited. The dragon continued to watch him, head lifted, yellow eyes fixed. They stared at each other for long moments, each waiting to see what the other would do. Penn listened to the sound of the dragon's breathing and smelled its fetid stench. He forced himself to ignore the urge to gag. Instead, he focused on his determination to keep going. When he felt he had waited long enough, he took another step. This time, the dragon slowly extended one great spiked foreleg in the manner of a cat toying with a mouse that had become its favorite plaything. It took its time, reaching out slowly and leisurely until the foreleg was stretched directly across the path Penn had intended to take, blocking it. Penn stared at the dragon in dismay, then slowly backed into the rocks once more. He spent the rest of the day hoping for a miracle. If only the dragon would grow bored. If only it would grow hungry. If only it would leave just for a few minutes. Didn't it have something else to do or somewhere else to go? Dragons must have lives like other creatures, habits and patterns of behavior that this one would be compelled to act on eventually. If he was just patient, if he could just wait it out, it would have to move on. Daylight faded and night set in. It began to rain, a soft, steady drizzle. Penn stuck his head far enough out of the shelter to catch a few drops in his open mouth, then used his cloak to gather a little more and sucked the water from the cloth. All the while, the dragon lay there, its scaly hide glistening, its eyes lidded, watching the dark wand and its glowing runes. Eventually, Penn grew sleepy once more. He worried for a short while about what the staff would do when he closed his eyes, then dismissed the matter. Apparently, it would continue to glow just as it must have done the previous night when the dragon was first attracted, just as it must have done while he was napping earlier. Otherwise, the dragon would have eaten him already. He wondered again how the staff could function independently of his thoughts when it had seemed before that it relied on them. He was missing something, wasn't picking up on what should have been obvious if he wasn't so hungry and exhausted. He wished he could think more clearly, that he could reason better. He closed his eyes and dreamed about his home and his parents, about how things had been not 2 months earlier. He had been so anxious for an adventure, so willing for a change in his mundane existence. He had embraced the chance to go in search of the Tanaquil with Tagwin and the others. He had relished the excitement that would result. He wished now that none of it had ever happened. He wished that things were back to the way they had been. He fell asleep, and his wishes drifted away.
Chapter 12. Dreams. Bits and pieces of incomplete thoughts and unfinished stories came and went with the swiftness of shadows and light
in a cloud-swept forest. They were bright and bold and filled with promise, and Beck Olmsford rode them like a bird across landscapes that stretched away forever. Sometimes he was in motion for the duration of the dream without ever touching the earth. Sometimes he felt the solid ground just long enough to be reassured that it was still there before winging away again. Nothing of what he saw was familiar to him. People came and went in the course of his travels, but he did not know who they were or why they were there. He had left his waking life behind. He had gone ahead of those he once knew. It could have been a time of peace and contentment, but the dreams were interspersed with nightmares, and the nightmares were horrifying. Some were memories of things in his past, of creatures and events that he could never forget. Some were dark prophecies of what lay ahead if he could not turn aside in time. All were populated with predators that pursued him relentlessly, hunters of a sort that lacked recognizable purpose or intent. They came at him in waves, and no matter where he fled or tried to hide, they meant to have him. Dreams and nightmares. There was no recognizable connection between the one and the other, and he transitioned between light and dark visions with distressing unpredictability. He slept, but his sleep was not sound or restful. The strange mix left him plagued with anxiety over which would appear next and how he would deal with it. He sought to combat them by gaining a measure of control, but his efforts fragmented and failed. He sought to wake, swimming upward through the waters of his sleep toward the bright surface of waking, but the distance was too great. Each time he felt himself getting close, the nightmares would come and drag him down again. He did not know how long the ordeal continued, but it was a considerable time. At times, he came close to crying out his frustration at being unable to break the chains that bound him to a sleep from which there seemed to be no waking. Perhaps he did cry out. He couldn't be sure. But no one came to help. No one reached to take his hand and pull him clear. He struggled on, alone, battling to keep the dark from overshadowing the light. Then, something changed. He did not know what it was or how it came to pass, but suddenly, the dreams and the nightmares withdrew, fading like wind-blown dust. He was left wrapped in warm silence, in a quietude he had not experienced before. He found solace in his isolation. He was able to breathe normally, to ease down into a comforting sleep that allowed him to rest in the way he needed, deeply and peacefully. For he had been injured, he knew. He had suffered damage of some sort, though he could not put a name to it. He slept because his body was trying to heal, but the injuries were severe enough that it was not certain yet that he could do so. He knew that without being able to say how. He knew it without being able to remember the specifics of what had happened to him. What he knew was he was fighting to survive, and the battle had been going badly. But the tide had turned, and the storm had receded, and his damaged body was healing. He dropped deep into a place in which a sense of calm prevailed, and no dark things were allowed. He was so grateful for it that he wanted to cry in happiness and relief. The possibility that he had died occurred to him, but he dismissed it. His physical state did not feel like death, unless death was something very different than he had imagined. It felt like living, as if life had found him again. Time passed. His sleep stretched away like a deep blue ocean, and the world about him began to take shape again. It assumed color and definition in the way a landscape is revealed by the lifting of a fog. As it did so, he found himself in the most beautiful gardens he had ever seen. The gardens were of varying sorts, different shapes and sizes and formations. Some were carefully cultivated beds, each given over to a flower and a theme. Some were hanging, vines and blankets of moss cascading off walls and trellises. Some were hillside and some meadow. There were flowering plants and bushes and grasses, great ancient trees with broad leafy canopies shaded portions of the gardens, while bright sunshine flooded the rest. The colors were vibrant and shimmering like the bands of a rainbow after a storm, blankets of one color and quilts of many. Amid the radiance rose the buzzing of bees as they pollinated flowers and the bright whistle and chirps of birds as they did all the things birds do. Wisps of clouds floated overhead, passing across the sun, casting strange, fleeting shadows on the earth. It was a vision of paradise. Beck Ohmsford stood in the center of it and marveled. The gardens weren't real. They couldn't be. They were only dreamed. Yet in his sleep, he found them as real as the flesh of his own body.
"Welcome, Beck Ohmsford," a soft voice whispered from behind him.
He turned and found an old man staring at him, an ancient, wearing a white robe and carrying a long, bleached wooden staff. White hair tumbled from his head to his shoulders and from chin to chest. His face was deeply lined and careworn in a way that suggested that he had been waging a long, hard fight. But his blue eyes were the eyes of a child, bright and interested and filled with expectation.
"This is my home," the old man said,
a smile deepening the wrinkles of his face. Beck looked around, confused. He was asleep. He was dreaming. But he felt as if he were awake. Was he?
"You have never been here," the old man continued, as if reading his mind. "But we have met before, a long time ago. Do you remember?"
Beck nodded slowly, realization dawning.
"You are the king of the Silver River."
The old man nodded.
"I am the last of my kind. The last of the words, children. I am keeper of these gardens, guardian of the Silver River, and watcher over the races. I am also friend to the Ohmsfords. Do you remember when I helped you?"
Beck did. He had been only a boy, dispatched on a quest he had barely understood to a land no one had ever visited before. He was called Beck Rowe then, and he did not yet know of his Ohmsford heritage. While his companions slept, the king of the Silver River had come to him to give him glimpses of the truth about himself and his sister, who was then the Ill's Witch, and not yet Ard Rhys of the Third Druid Order. It was the beginning of a journey of discovery that would change the lives of brother and sister forever. That had been a long time ago, in a different life.
"I have come to help you again," the old man said. "I do so because I promised your son that I would, although I am late in keeping that promise."
"Pen?" Beck asked in surprise.
"Penderyn, who has gone to find the Ard Rhys and bring her back to us. Penderyn, who is beyond our reach now."
The seamed face dipped momentarily into shadow.
"Walk with me."
Beck fell into step beside him, thinking again that what was happening wasn't real, that it was only a dream come to him in his sleep, but knowing instinctively that it was important nevertheless. He was being given a vision, a fever dream. In this vision, he might be shown truths that would help him find his son. "Why is Penn beyond our reach?" he asked, impatient with waiting for the other to speak. The aged head lifted slightly, one hand gesturing in a quick, dismissive motion.
"It only matters that he is. It only matters that he must be. I would have told you sooner. I would have come to you. I promised him I would weeks ago when I first appeared to him in the Black Oaks while he was fleeing from the Druids. He relied on me to tell you, to warn you of the danger, but I could not risk it. Had I told you, you would have gone in search of him. You would have promised me not to, but you would have gone anyway. Had you found him and rescued him, everything that must happen in its own time would have failed to happen at all."
Beck shook his head. "Are you saying you deliberately stopped me from helping Penn by not telling me what was happening to him?"
"I am saying that I stopped you from thinking you were helping him when in truth you would have been doing the opposite."
"I don't understand. Why are you telling me this now since you chose not to before?" The childlike eyes fixed on him.
"Because now your help is needed. But it is needed in an entirely different way from before, and it will not be so easy to give."
They walked on, not speaking. Beck, floating within his vision, dreaming through his sleep, was a disembodied presence with thoughts and emotions, but a lack of substance. It left him feeling oddly removed from what was happening, even while participating. He experienced a need to grasp onto something hard and strong, something real and true. But the words of the King of the Silver River were all he had.
"This is what has happened, Beck Ormsford," the old man said finally. "Druids within the Order have conspired against the Ard Rhys. They found a way to banish her to a place from which she cannot return without help. Your son has gone to find her. He was asked to do so by me, because I knew he was the only one who could make the journey and return. He did not think himself equal to the task, but I convinced him otherwise, and now he has convinced himself. He has crossed a barrier that no other may cross to reach the Ard Rhys. When he finds her, he will bring her back through that barrier, and they must both face their destinies."
He paused, looking over at Beck. The look seemed intended both to measure and to reassure.
"Your son and your sister are inside the Forbidding."
Beck turned sharply toward the old man, but the heavy staff struck the earth hard enough that he could feel the blow through his feet.
"Don't speak. Just listen. Shadea Aru and her minions believe they have orchestrated the imprisonment of the Ard Rhys through their own cleverness and skill. But they are mistaken. They have been tricked by one of the demons that dwell within the Forbidding. That demon is a warlock, a sorcerer of great power. Its goal was to exchange the Ard Rhys for another demon, bringing her into the Forbidding in order to free one of its own to come into this world. That exchange has taken place. The demon set free now seeks to destroy the Forbidding so that all those imprisoned since the time of Faerie will be freed. The demon must be stopped, or the Four Lands are lost. You must stop it."
Beck shook his head. The charge weighed on him like a set of chains. "How?" The old man slowed and turned to face him. The childlike eyes were kind and reassuring.
"I did not come to tell you of your son or warn you of your own danger before this, because Penderyn alone was needed to cross into the Forbidding, and you would have stopped him. Penderyn knows that he must find and rescue his aunt. He has the means and the will to accomplish this. I think he will succeed. But he does not know that when the Ard Ris was sent into the Forbidding, a demon was sent into our world. He only knows that he must use the talisman he has been given to rescue your sister and bring her out again. He believes. That is the extent of what is required of him. This was my decision, too. Telling him the rest would have crushed him.
He turned and began walking again, his steps careful and measured. Beck stayed at his side, waiting impatiently to hear more. All around them, breezes rippled the petals of the flowers and gave the impression that they walked upon the surface of a multi-hued sea.
"The talisman Pen carries is called a dark wand," the old man said. "Penderyn has already used it to cross into the Forbidding. Once he finds the Ard Ris, he will use it to cross back again."
He paused.
"But there is one thing more he must do. What has been done must be undone, not in part, but in whole. In order for matters to be put right, everything that the combined magic of the demons and the druids has brought to pass must be put back. Therefore, not only must the Ard Ris be returned to this world, but the demon must be put back inside the Forbidding. The Dark Wand possesses the magic to do this, but only Pen has the power to wield it. He must find the demon and use the Dark Wand against it."
He looked at Beck.
"You are the one who must see that he has the chance to do so."
"What am I supposed to do?" The old man looked away again.
"Two things. First, you must find a way to protect your son when he crosses back through the Forbidding with the Ard Ris. They must return to exactly the same place they went in, her sleeping chamber at Paranor."
"Where Shadea and the others will be waiting," Beck finished. The old man nodded.
"Second, you must find the demon. It will not look like a demon. It will look like something else. It is a changeling and takes the shapes of other creatures. This one is particularly dangerous. It absorbs its victims and becomes them. You must find out which disguise it has assumed and unmask it."
Beck looked down at his feet. He couldn't see them. He didn't seem to have feet, even though he could feel himself walking.
"The Dark Wand will reveal the demon," the old man said. "The talisman will respond to its presence. It will tell you who or what the demon is, if you get close enough."
The scent of tube roses filled Beck's nostrils, sweet and heady. He shook off the distraction. "The wish song told me that Pen was at Taupo Ruff in the Upper Einar."
"The wish song did not lie. But now he is inside the Forbidding."
"So I must go back to Paranor to find my son?" The King of the Silver River turned to face him.
"The path that leads to your son does not begin at Paranor. It begins at Taupo Ruff with Penderyn's companions. The dwarf, the rock troll, and the elven girl will provide you with keys to the doors that you must open to reach him."
He paused.
"It is not within the Forbidding that Penderyn faces his greatest danger. It is here. The druids will know where he has gone and be waiting for him when he returns. If they reach him before you do, they will kill him."
"Nothing will happen to my son while I am alive," Beck said at once. He felt a subtle shift in his surroundings as he made that vow, a shimmering in the air, a ripple in the blankets and clusters of flowers, a whispering of breezes. And he knew he had committed himself in a way that could not be undone. The old man nodded.
Do you feel the weight of your words, Beck Ormsford? They have sealed your fate.
He stepped aside, an effortless movement that belonged to a much younger man. His ancient face lifted and changed. He was something else now. An old man no longer, another creature entirely. Not human. Not of this world. Beck backed away involuntarily, hands coming up to ward off the thing that stood before him. The King of the Silver River had become a monster.
See the future, human,
the monster rasped, teeth showing, eyes bright with hate.
Look upon it. When the forbidding falls, your world becomes mine.
Then, the gardens withered before Beck's eyes, the flowers dying, their colors fading and their stalks wilting. The great shade trees lost their leaves, and their branches took on the look of bones blackened by fire. The grasses dried and cracked, and all sights and sounds of life disappeared. Overhead, the sky lost its brightness, its deathless blue becoming as gray as ashes, misted and empty. Beck knew at once he was being given a glimpse of what his world would become if the demon set loose by the unthinking rebel druids was successful in bringing down the forbidding and setting free its denizens. When that happened, his world would become the world of the forbidding. It would be the end of everything that mattered.
Do not fail.
The words echoed softly in the rapidly diminishing sweep of daylight, and Beck turned swiftly to seek the King of the Silver River, to protest that he would not, to give fresh voice to his promise to do as he had been asked, but found he was alone. He woke with a gasp, jerked from his sleep by a sense of impending horror, his body racked by pain and fever, and his mind roiling with wild, uncontrollable emotions that careened through him like tiny razors, jagged edges cutting. He tried to speak, and could not. He tried to see, to discover where he was, but his surroundings were blurred and indistinct. He felt a slight rolling motion beneath him, and heard the creak and groan of wood and metal fastenings, of lashings, and the wind's steady rush. He was aboard a ship, but he couldn't understand how he had gotten there.
Penderin is inside the forbidding.
It was his first thought, and the realization all but stopped his heart. Pen, in that monstrous prison where so much of what was evil in the world had been banished. That the King of the Silver River would send his son to such a place was impossible for him to understand. How could a mere boy have any chance at all of surviving? How could he hope to find his aunt and bring her back again, when everything he encountered would be looking to kill him? But it is not inside the forbidding that Penderin faces his greatest danger.
Beck, can you hear me?
He took a deep, steadying breath and blinked against the haze that clouded his vision. A face swam into view, young, and with skin ghostly pale, framed with a helmet of close-cropped black hair, a slender hand reached out to touch his cheek.
Can you hear me?
He nodded, his mouth too dry to allow him to speak. Seeing his difficulty, she raised his head from the bedding on which he lay, brought a cup of water to his lips, and allowed him to sip. Intense dark eyes peered into his.
Do you remember me?
she asked. I'm Belazin. I'm Trefin Mori's friend. He nodded weakly, remembering nothing.
Where am I?
Aboard Swift Shore. You've been very sick, Beck. You were badly hurt, a knife wound deep in your side and an arrow through your shoulder. You have been delirious for 2 days, fighting off a fever. I think it is broken, finally. It all came back to him in a rush, his escape from Paranor with Rue, helped by the young druid, Trefin Mori's, the battle to reach Swift Shore with the gnome hunters attacking from every quarter in an effort to stop them, his collapse moments after finally managing to reach the rope ladder, and then... nothing. This girl had been aboard the airship waiting for them. He remembered looking up into her face as they placed him on the deck, and she bent to tend his wounds.
You helped me, he said.
Healing is my druid skill, she replied, giving him a quick, reassuring smile. Rue sails the airship. Trefin lends her a hand where it is needed, and I care for you. We each have our task. Mine seemed the harder for a time. I was afraid I was going to lose you. He thought back to the dreams and nightmares of his sleep, already growing distant and vague in his memory. He thought back to the fever dream, to his vision of the King of the Silver River. He had turned the corner into recovery then, he believed. He had been near death, but the dream had brought him back to life. He shivered at the memory of what the dream had shown him, the images of a desiccated, demon-invaded world, still fresh in his mind. Belazin gave him another few sips of water from the cup, and then laid him back down again. You still need to rest. She started to rise, but he reached out for her arm.
Is everyone else all right?
She turned back. Rue was hurt too, though not as badly as you. Several arrow wounds, but they were quick to begin healing once I cleaned them and applied the necessary salves. She moves slowly still, but she is able to sail the airship. Yours was the wound we were most worried about. I did not think we could save you unless we went to Storlock for help from the healers, but Rue said that was the first place the druids would look for you. I have some skill with infection and fevers. I worked the front on the Precandoran for a year in my early training. We decided not to chance going to Storlock. She stopped, her face turning somber. I am talking too much. You need to rest. I will tell Rue you are awake.
Wait,
he said again. He swallowed against the tightness in his throat, against the urgency he was feeling at needing to act on his dream.
How long have I been like this?
A little more than 3 days.
3 days.
A lifetime.
Where are we?
Above the Strelaheim, flying north along the western exposure of the Einar Mountains. She hesitated. We stopped last night so that I could collect plants to treat your wound, and to allow you a chance to sleep on solid ground for one night. But Rue said we had to go on this morning, that we could not afford to delay longer. The druids would be after us, and we needed to find your son before they did. That's where we are flying.
To Taupo Ruff?
To Taupo Ruff. You told us just before you lost consciousness that this was where the Scry Waters showed him to be.
But where he no longer was,
Beck thought. Still, it was where they must begin their search for his companions, whose help the King of the Silver River had said they would need, keys that would open doors to reach him.
What did that mean?
Rest now, Belazin said, touching his arm as she rose. He exhaled slowly and laid back, and she was gone before he could say anything more. He lay in the ensuing silence, and stared up at the beams of his cabin, at the underside of the decking, at the windows through which the heavy streamers of daylight shone. It was all so familiar. but he had the feeling that the familiar was rapidly vanishing, and that what lay ahead would be as strange and new as the idea of Penderyn and Grian inside the forbidding. He closed his eyes for a moment to rest them, and immediately fell asleep. Chapter 13. When Beck Ormsford woke, he was alone. He lay in his bed staring up at the same patch of the decking's underside that he had been looking at when he fell asleep. Cross beams, rough planking, wooden dowels, and iron nails all fitted into place. He felt the sway of the airship and knew she was still flying. Outside, the light was pale and washed of color. It was twilight, he guessed, or the gray of a new dawn. He wondered how much time had passed. He wondered how far they had come. For a while, he lay without moving, allowing himself to come fully awake, taking time to test the limits of his strength. He found, bound about his waist, the compress that protected the knife wound, as well as the bandage to his shoulder. Both wounds ached, but no more than he might have expected them to. He moved his arms and legs without difficulty, and even managed to lift himself up on one elbow, although the effort caused a sharp twinge in his injured side. He lay back, feeling appreciably better than he had when he had first regained consciousness. Still, he accepted that he was not yet at full strength. He reached for the cup of water that Bellizen had left at his bedside and drank deeply. The water was sweet and cool, and it helped clear his head of sleep. He thought he might be able to get out of bed and up on deck if he took his time, but he would have to try standing, and he would have to dress. It would not be easy. He was working his way into a sitting position when the door to his cabin opened and Rue appeared. "What do you think you're doing?" she snapped, rushing over and pushing him down again. Her face reflected a mix of concern and irritation, but it softened almost at once as she leaned down and kissed him. "Wait a bit. You're not ready yet."
"I feel better," he said.
"Apparently. But how you think you feel doesn't necessarily reflect how you really are." She sat down beside him. "Didn't Bellizen tell you how worried we were? You lied to me about that knife wound. It was much worse than you said."
"I just wanted to get out of there. I wasn't thinking about the wound."
"We almost lost you, Beck."
He smiled. "You can't lose me as easy as that."
"I hope not."
She ran the tip of one finger across his cheek.
"Losing you would be too much for me."
She kissed him again, and he kissed her back, holding her close, even though it hurt both his side and shoulder to do so. When she pulled away, she brushed back her short-cropped hair and shook her head in despair.
"You risk too much, Beck Ormsford. You take too many chances."
"I must have learned that from you," he answered, laughing. "Let's be honest for a moment. Who in the world ever took more chances than you?" She nodded, conceding the point.
"But you feel better, do you?"
She held her hand against his forehead for a moment.
"Your fever is broken. You're much cooler. Earlier you were burning up and delirious, thrashing and talking about things none of us could understand. You were dreaming or having nightmares. Do you remember any of it?"
"I remember what matters," he said quietly.
Then he told her of his vision and of the words of the King of the Silver River. He was surprised to see her cry when she learned that Penn was inside the forbidding, but immediately afterward she was angry and quick to blame Grian. If not for her, none of this would be happening. Their lives were caught up in hers, snared in her druid machinations and political maneuverings, held prisoner by her web of intrigues and subterfuges. She might not be the ill's witch any longer, but as Ard Rhys, she inspired the same hostility and enmity. Anyone connected with her, whether by blood or by alliance, suffered as a result. None of them would ever be free of her entanglements. Beck tried to reason with her, but there was no doing so while her son was in such terrible danger, and her anger so great because of it. So he quickly gave it up, instead turning the discussion a different way.
"You did the right thing by keeping us flying toward Taupo Ruff. If the King of the Silver River is to be believed, our chance for helping Penn lies in first finding his companions."
She frowned at him. "Are we to believe him, Beck? Are we to believe any of those who harbor secrets? We know better than to trust the druids. Should we trust a creature like the King of the Silver River any farther?"
Beck shrugged.
"I think we have to. Penn trusted him. Which put our son inside the forbidding. You make my point.
But maybe we have to extend our trust a little farther in order to get him out again. After all, what other choice do we have?
We haven't another way of reaching Penn. I hate this," she snapped. "I hate that everything we do is dictated by these secret keepers, fairies and druid alike. Everything that has happened is their doing. We are just their pawns."
He nodded. "I know what we are. But we are thinking pawns, and in the end, we will make our own decisions. For now, we have to follow the path we have been put upon and hope that it leads us to where we want to go. That path takes us first to Taupo Ruff." She took a deep breath and exhaled slowly.
"All right. Taupo Ruff."
She looked out the window at the graying light. "Dusk comes. You've been asleep for more than a day, but we traveled on while you slept. We should reach the village before dawn. You should go back to sleep while you can. Or would you like something to eat first?"
He chose to eat, and she sat with him while he did. He was heartened to find that her anger gradually lessened and her mood lightened,
and he did not argue with her when she told him to go back to sleep afterward. She kissed him and told him she loved him, and he told her that he loved her too. It was as much as they needed to say. It was enough to leave things at that. He slept then, surprised to discover that sleep came again so quickly and easily. He was still sleeping when Rue reappeared to tell him that they were almost at their destination. She helped him sit up, and then stand, and when he found he was strong enough to do more, she helped him dress and walked him up on deck. It was night still, but the first tinges of dawn were visible east along the crest of the mountains. The land they sailed through was stark and barren, a vast, sweeping plain to the west that climbed into foothills east, which in turn rose to the jagged majesty of the charnels. Small clumps of trees, tiny silver-webbed streams, and small lakes that reflected the moonlight brightened an otherwise rocky terrain. Beck knew that country. He had explored it with Rue once upon a time, but few expeditions went that way, and he had not been there in years. Trefin Morris was at the helm and nodded to him as he climbed into the pilot box.
"Good to see you looking well again," he said.
Bellazin came over the port railing and joined them, her pale oval face shining with moonlight.
"Are we close, Rue?"
Rue Meridian nodded, then said to Beck, "Tell them everything you told me. They need to hear it from you." Beck did so, his words floating away from him as he spoke them in the soft rush of the wind, the night air swift and cool, the world vast and dark about their little circle. He covered everything, making certain to include the words of the King of the Silver River that suggested the Ard Rhys was alive and that Penn could reach her. When he was finished, Bellazin spoke first.
"It sounds so impossible.
A boy is the only one who can bring the Ard Ris back? A boy with no magic, no special skills?
She looked quickly at Rue.
I do not doubt his determination, but I do question the reason for the choosing of him.
No more than I, Rue said. But Beck keeps nothing from us. The secrets for which we seek answers belong to the King of the Silver River. If we wish to discover those answers, we will have to discover them another way. Penn might know some of them. The Ard Ris might know the rest.
We will seek those answers with you, Trefin Morris assured her quickly. We will do whatever is necessary to find my mistress. If your son can lead us to her, then we will find him and help him as best we can. But first, it appears, we need to find his companions. Three were named. The dwarf would be Tagwin. The rock troll would be Kermadec. Once, he was captain of her guard, and he remains her close friend. Taupo Ruff is his home, he paused. But who is the elven girl?
Beck shook his head.
I wish I knew.
He wished he knew as well why the King of the Silver River had made no mention of Arryn Elessadil. The druids had said Tagwin had gone to him for help first before going to Pendaren. Shouldn't there also have been some reference to him? But he said nothing of his worry to the others. He stood at the railing and watched the ground sweep away as Swiftsure sped onward along the line of the mountains. Rue took several compass readings and directed Trefin Morris, whom she had allowed to keep the helm. She must have been working with him, Beck thought. The young druid had no flying skills, no experience with weapons, and he had learned both in a very short time under less than ideal circumstances. But he was doing better than many would have. The sky continued to brighten slowly, the darkness giving way to a silvery wash that gradually turned golden. Ahead, the buildings of a fortified settlement came into view, a village built back against a cliff wall. But there were no fires in the village, and no signs of movement. Dark smears dotted the plains, fronting the village walls, and the village itself had a ragged, neglected look. As they drew nearer, he saw that sections of the walls had been breached, and the greater number of buildings were collapsed and blackened by fire.
Are we in the right place? He asked Rue.
She nodded, her face dark with concern.
This is Taupo Ruff. Not what we expected, is it? Someone has been here before us.
Beck did not care to speculate on who that someone might have been. It was possible that the druids had gotten to the village ahead of them, but the destruction did not look recent. There were no fires burning, no lingering curtains of smoke, no battle smells, nothing to suggest that anything had happened here for days. They landed the airship at the edge of the walls, and while he stayed at the helm, the other three went down the rope ladder to have a look around. He hated being left behind, but as Rue sensibly pointed out, he was too weak to be making long treks, so he contented himself with watching their progress and trying to fit together in his own mind the story of what had happened here. By the time the sun was fully up, white hot in a cloudless sky, they were back, grim-faced and empty-handed.
A battle was fought here perhaps 2 weeks ago, Rue reported. At least one druid warship was brought down in the fighting and burned. The remains lie out on the flats. So the battle was probably between the rock trolls of the village and the druids. There are gnome weapons and pieces of armor, so gnomes probably fought in the service of the druids. Hard to tell for certain what happened, but in the end, the trolls fled into the cliffs. There are caves in those cliffs, and I would imagine tunnels that connect to the far side of the mountains.
This must have all happened because of Penn, Beck said. This is Kermadec's home. Penn and the others would have come to him for help. The druids tracked them here while we were imprisoned at Paranor and tried to take Penn prisoner. Kermadec refused to give him up, so the village was sacked. Rue nodded, brushing back loose strands of her auburn hair. But where did Penn and his protectors go from here? What route did they take?
They went in search of the Dark Wand,
Bellizen answered her.
Somewhere in these mountains,
Trefin Maurice added.
Or somewhere beyond.
Bellizen looked at Beck.
Can you track your son's passage from here as you did at Paranor?
Beck shook his head doubtfully.
The battle had happened days ago, and Penn had been gone from there a long time. He wasn't in the mountains anymore. He wasn't even on the same world. In any case, Beck's connection was with his son, not with those who had accompanied him. His magic might not allow him to track them as he had Penn. But he knew he had to try.
There's nothing here for us, he said.
Not unless we try tracking them through the tunnels. Why don't we fly to the other side of the cliffs and see if we can pick up a trail?
They did so, Rue taking the helm, not trusting anyone else to navigate in a place where the winds could prove unpredictable and a moment's inattention could send an airship into the rocks. Keeping Beck beside her in the pilot box, she sent the young druids to the starboard and port forward draws to work the lines by hand in case of heavy turbulence. But they were lucky that day. The winds were mild and the way into the mountains clear. Swift Shore sailed through gaps in the jagged peaks, unhindered and unchallenged, and by midday they had reached a valley that lay between the peaks of the Clue. While the airship hovered midway across the valley, Beck used the wish song to seek out some sign of Penn or his companions. He had learned the trick from his sister years earlier. As the Ill's witch, she had used the wish song to track him. Later, on the long voyage home, she had showed him how. He would see if it could be made to work the same way for him. It was something of a gamble to do so. Any use of his magic would alert Shadea and her druids to their presence and remove any doubt about where they were. On the other hand, she would know already where they were going and what they were trying to do, so he really wasn't giving all that much away. And if she had discovered that Penn was inside the Forbidding, she might have lost all interest in pursuing them anyway. Whatever the case, without the use of the wish song, they had no way of knowing where to go. Eyes closed for better concentration, he sang the magic, slow and smooth, like a carpet being spread across the valley floor, searching for traces of passage. He found several, all of them more than a week old, and none distinct enough to identify. Frustrated, he spread his net a little wider, reaching deeper into the peaks ahead, into the mountains of the Clue that fronted the huge forests of the Incrum. There, far beyond anywhere he could see, he found traces of his son, tiny beacons in the ether. But the traces were unlike anything he had ever come across before, and for a moment, he didn't trust what the wish song was telling him. Still, his certainty that it was Penderin and not someone else was so strong that he could not ignore it. He broke off his efforts, the wish song dying into silence, his breathing quieted, and his eyes opened once more. "I found him," he said. "Traces of him, anyway. Deeper into the mountains ahead, east." He paused, looking now at Rue. "But something's wrong. What I found wasn't familiar to me. It wasn't what I know of Penn. What I found of his passing was tinged with magic." She stared at him. "Magic? Whose magic?"
"His own."
She shook her head.
"That is impossible. He doesn't have any magic. He's never had any magic. We both know that."
He held her gaze. "Nevertheless,
you must be mistaken. You have to be."
He could tell from the way she said it that she needed him to be wrong. that she was frightened at the prospect that the Ohmsford heritage might have been passed on to her son, after all. He could discern her thinking. She had believed Penn safely removed from the Wishsong's influence, the bloodline dying out with Beck. What if she had been mistaken? What if the magic had simply lain dormant? It had done so with Beck. Was it so strange that it should do so with his son as well? "I don't think we can decide about this until we talk to Penn," he said carefully. "What matters is that I feel certain I found his route of passage. We can track him now." "What if what you've found is his passage coming out rather than going in?" Trefin Maurice asked suddenly. It was an uncomfortable thought. There was no way to determine the answer from where they stood. There might not be a way to determine the answer once they reached the source. It might be a long, dangerous journey to their destination, and the journey might well yield nothing. But it was all they had to work with. It was the only lead they had been given. "I think we have to try following it, for a time at least," Beck offered, looking to Rue for support. His wife studied him, her fine, clear features masking what she was feeling, keeping hidden the wash of doubts and fears he knew she must be experiencing. She stayed silent for a long time, considering. Then she nodded. "Beck is right. We have to try." They turned Swiftsure's bow toward the clue and flew east for the remainder of the day into peaks wrapped in storm clouds and layers of mist, buffeted by heavy winds. Swiftsure was battered and tossed, and her occupants thrown from side to side. Beck was sent below to help protect his wounds, and the other three strapped on safety harnesses while on deck. By the end of the day, all three were drenched and freezing, their bodies aching and their minds numb from the effort of holding course and staying aloft. Snow was flying all about them in thick gusts, threatening whiteouts at every turn, cloaking cliff walls and passages alike, so that the way forward remained an ever-changing mystery. As darkness approached, Rue Meridian began to despair. If they did not get clear of the mountains quickly, she would have to set down, and there was nowhere for her to do that. Flying blind at night could have only one result. She called Beck back up on deck and had him use the wish song again, searching for a way to go. But the magic failed Beck this time, refusing to give up anything at all that would help, leaving them adrift and at risk. Finally, when it seemed that no help was to be had from any quarter and the outcome of their efforts unavoidable, the storms subsided and the peaks ahead opened into the valley of the Incrim. Rue took Swiftsure through as the last of the day's light gave way to a scattering of stars, and no visible moon, just a faint brightening that allowed her enough illumination to set down at the edge of the trees at the rim of the valley. They slept then, exhausted from their efforts. All but Beck. Awake and awash in fresh doubts, he sat alone in the pilot box, wrapped in a blanket, thinking about what they were doing. He understood the need for it. He understood as well the reasons. What bothered him was the number of uncertainties. Trefin Maurice had been right about tracking Penn's passage. It was probably impossible to determine which way the boy was going, absent some physical evidence. He told himself that if he could locate just one of his companions, they would have a way of finding his son. But he was bothered most by something he had kept from Rue. The traces of Penn he had found had been infused with wish-song magic. Not just any magic, but wish-song magic. He hadn't thought Rue needed to know that just yet. She was distressed enough about the presence of any magic where their son was concerned, and would have been beside herself to learn that the magic had its origins in the Ohmsford bloodline. But there was no mistaking its nature. He should have felt a measure of relief. If Penn had the use of the wish song, he was in a better position to protect himself. But in fact, Beck was as upset about the prospect as his wife. He didn't want Penn to have the burden of the wish song any more than she did. Too many generations of Olmsfords had struggled with it. Too many had seen their lives altered irrevocably as a result, and not always for the better. It had been so with him. He had hoped that his son might have an easier road. He thought about it for a long time. He tried to picture Penn within the forbidding, and failed. How could anyone imagine what that must be like? He knew what sort of creatures the forbidding contained, but no one knew what it would feel like to be a human trapped there. That Penderin should have been sent to find and retrieve Grianne was still something he could not fathom. The King of the Silver River had given him no reason for the choice of his son as rescuer. There would be a reason, he knew, and the reason might have something to do with Penn's use of the wish song. Yet, if that was so, why hadn't the fairy creature come to Beck, who had more experience and better command of the magic? Why had Penn been chosen? It had to be something else, something about Penn that wasn't true of Beck. He fell asleep at some point and woke to the sound of the others coming up on deck. He was stiff from sleeping upright, but overall he felt better than he had the day before. He felt stronger, more ready. He was mending. He was coming back to himself. The day was clear and bright ahead of them, the storms of the clue left behind. After they had eaten from their steadily dwindling stores, Beck used the wish song to seek anew the traces of Penn he had found the other day. He found them with little trouble. They were stronger, and he was better able to read them. The magic that had infused them a day earlier was more diverse than he had believed, a mix of couplings that involved his son and someone or something else. The source of the traces lay ahead, deep within the Incrim. After checking the radian draws and light sheaths for breaks and tears and finding everything intact, Rue took swift shore off the ground, pointed her east across the sweep of the forested valley, and sailed in search of Beck's findings. It was nearing midday when Trefin Maurys, who had been keeping watch at the bow for the better part of an hour, called back, "There are ruins down there." Rue dropped swift shore into a slow descent toward the canopy of trees, following the young druid's shouted directions. Within minutes, the ruins were visible to them all. Remnants of buildings sprawled for miles, a jumble of broken walls, columns, and battlements. What little remained had been overgrown by trees and scrub, enveloped by the foliage of the jungle. In places, wildflowers formed bright patches amid the blanketing shadows. "There are people down there!" Trefin Maurys shouted suddenly. Beck went forward at once, picking his way gingerly across the decking to where the druids stood. They were only 100 feet above the canopy by then, and able to see the whole of the valley clearly. As Beck came up beside him, Trefin Maurys pointed. Gnarled, string-thin forms darted about the rubble at the edges of the ruins, creatures similar to gnomes, but clearly something else. "Urdas," Beck said aloud. He recognized them from earlier expeditions he had made into the charnels. He saw them look up as Swift Shore hove into view, repositioning themselves to meet the newly perceived threat, brandishing slings and bows and arrows. "Keep us flying, Rue," he shouted over his shoulder. "What are they doing?" Trefin Maurys asked him. He shook his head. "I don't know. Keep your eyes open." He went back to the pilot box and climbed up beside Rue and Bellazin, telling them what he had seen. "They've ringed the ruins. I think they're looking for something. Maybe the same thing we're looking for." He decided to use the wish song again, to seek anew the traces of Penn's passing he had sensed that morning. He found them immediately, strong and clear and just ahead in the ruins. The magic was diffuse and fading, days old and no longer clearly defined, but its use had been powerful and reflected both determination and clear intent. Penn had experienced an epiphany or confrontation of major proportions. If he had survived that, Beck thought, then there was some reason to believe he could survive the forbidding. Ahead, 5 degrees east-southeast, he told Rue, pointing for emphasis. Swiftsure altered course slightly and flew on, Rue holding the airship's speed down so they could scan the ruins below for other signs of life. They were flying along the southern perimeter, and there were Urdas scattered all along it. They seemed reluctant to go further in. Beck remembered that the Urdas were superstitious about places they considered sacred. The ruins might well be one such place. But the Urdas were clearly there for a reason. If they could not enter, then they were waiting for something that had.
Smoke!
Rue said suddenly, pointing off to the right. From just beyond the main body of the ruins, separated by a series of deep wooded rifts, a column of black smoke rose from a crumbling blockhouse and tower. The Urdas were all about it, 3 and 4 deep within the cover of trees and rocks, showering the fortifications with darts and arrows and spears.
I'd say we'd found something, Rue offered, giving Beck a quick glance.
But it was not something that tracked to the traces of Penn's passing that Beck had detected. It was something entirely apart. He hesitated, wondering how advisable it was to become distracted by something that might have nothing at all to do with what they were looking for.
All right, he said finally. Let's have a look.
Chapter 14. It was like flying into a hornet's nest. Swiftsure descended in a long, slow spiral, drawing the attention of the band of Urdas below. Beck had hoped that their appearance alone would prove startling enough to those superstitious people to make them withdraw. But instead of bolting back into the trees and seeking cover, the Urdas immediately turned their weapons on the airship. Treffen Morris barely had time to shout a warning from the bow when a hail of spears and darts struck the underside of the vessel and a wash of arrows arced over the railing in a deadly sweep.